I do, of course, want to thank you for all your kindness this recently. And also for the prayer for my father. They're doing well in recovery. He had that open heart surgery where they actually took his heart out of his body and worked on a table. I mean, this is, you know, I'm in Silicon Valley, and that still amazes me. And they put the valve in, and they put it back in, and he's out of recovery in a private room. And so doing well. And obviously the timing of that was pretty important for my family, so I appreciate that. So let's open in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for your love, your constant goodness, your faithfulness to us, your wisdom, your gentleness, your comfort, your people. God, it's this morning as we look at the things you have promised to deliver us from. We ask for your son's sake, amen. Well, I was in a hurry to get back because I have an axe to grind this morning. So we are in the syllabus called The Masters Described in the New Testament that we get freed from. We're on page 10, syllabus out of 23. And if you've been following this series for a couple of years, our whole point here is we've been trying to understand why this message by a group of less than gifted or least likely to become executives, people in first century Roman Palestine conquered the Roman Empire in the space of a couple hundred years. That somehow or another, when it was illegal and it was dangerous to profess this, and this wasn't a fashionable thing to do, and you sacrificed all your economic prospects to say, yes, I'm a follower of the Nazarene, why somehow or another that message was important to these people? Why people from every single social strata in all walks of life somehow said, forget the rest of this crap, I want that. That's what I want. I want that God, that promise, and that hope. And so that's what we've been looking at. The words that have been passed down through Western culture for these terms, ransom, redemption, sanctification, propitiate, you know, these mean so little to us. And what we've been trying to do is try to step back into the sandals of a centurion or of a rabbi or a fisherman or a tax collector and say, what would be the shock value? Why would this show up on shock TV as opposed to the more bland things that we hear today? What was the thing? And so we've been going through the phrases that God used to describe that event of the crucifixion. And the one that we've been on for this year has been redemption. And redemption and ransom, those terms. And again, like I said, they're not part of our Western culture much, so we don't have the shock value of those. And basically, we saw up so far that of the words that we've been using to describe, that God used in the New Testament to describe this, there are three. And the one that we've been focused on so far had to do with freedom, where you would literally buy someone that's in a bad situation and free them, lutron. So we've been looking at this, and the first thing we had to do, we had to go through this very detailed analysis of what Roman slavery was like, what Roman servitude was like, what were the characteristics of it, why was it bad, where was it good, and things of this type. And we're at the situation where lutron, this word redemption, meant somehow to buy somebody out of that bondage, buy somebody out of that and set them free. Okay, and that's the core word for this word that we're studying about redemption. And I hastened through the last time I was with you the various masters that were described in the New Testament from which we are to be freed from. In other words, if redemption means I get freed from an oppressive master to go free, okay, the obvious question is, who's oppressing me? Who are the oppressive masters in my life? In the Old Testament, we saw that those generally were things like foreign governments. They were creditors, or people that I owed money to, rather. They would be abusive situations I would find myself in. Sometimes it was a law courts where I was going to get what I deserved, you know, for a crime I'd committed. We saw how it sort of intensified through history to where sometimes it looked like the oppressive master was me, my heart, my hopes, my despairs, my whatevers that held me down from experiencing the goodness that God would have for me in my life. And so we have I just have this little excursus of the things that are described the masters in the New Testament from which God is anxious to deliver us. Okay? Anxious to deliver us. And so I hastily read through them in the interest of trying to get closer to being on time last time. But we're going to be a little more leisurely today on this. The first master there on page 10 is called sin. Now, sin's one of those fuzzy words, too. And sin, we've got, there's some eight to ten different words in the Greek for sin in the New Testament. And this particular one in this passage, Titus 2:14, is sin as the pull or impulse toward evil and selfishness. So this is just that tendency. The older theologians would call it that bent toward evil. That if you just took your hands off the steering wheel of the car and it just pulls over there to the right, and it doesn't matter how many alignments you get, somehow, right, you let go of the steering wheel, it pulls you over to the right. It's that something strange about our, we've got frame damage somehow. We've got frame damage that they didn't tell us about when we bought the used car, right? And this pull or impulse toward this evil and toward selfishness is shown here in the Titus passage. We know that the law is spiritual, but I am unspiritual, sold as a slave to sin, in Romans 7:14. And then in Titus, the work of Christ, that he might redeem us, buy us back out from every lawless deed. In other words, I am, in some level, in bondage to this something or another that subconsciously manipulates me, that, like I say, if I take my hands off the wheel, if I'm not, as the New Testament calls, alert, without being hypervigilant, just alert means just making sure you're staying close to the shepherd. Just, it's not just this real negative, legalistic thing. It's just checking in with God, keeping short accounts with God. And say, okay, so it's been 4 hours, how do we do? How am I doing? Where am I? Have I switched lanes already? am I over here? How am I doing? Okay, and keeping short accounts with God, and so one of the masters that we're trying to get freed from that God is working in our lives is this default, that the default is to be evil or selfish, and this is something that. Although we won't cover it for a couple years, in sanctification, it's what sanctification is about. It's about growing a second contradictory impulse that outshouts the other impulse, so that when you flip a coin more times, heads comes up than tails. Hebrews says, those who have, by reason of use, have exercised their senses to discern good from evil. In other words, by practice, you create these spirals of righteousness, where the default, when they cut you off in traffic, is not to curse them, but the default to say, maybe they have an urgency that I'm not aware of, and if I were in their shoes, I would like to be cut the benefit of the doubt, too. See, that's the knee-jerk that you want to get to so that you're not slandering ahead of time until it's appropriate to do so. And you know this person individually, and they left the breakfast table with you, right? So there's no real excuse for that kind of behavior. But God has built into the fruit of the Spirit and walking with the Lord a growth of this nature, a growth of this heart in us to be able to overcome this tendency in the short term. And then at the longer term, of course, the whole thing gets blown away. And we get the new body and it's just altogether gone. And then that which He has worked so hard to produce in our life is completely unbridled. To be good and gracious and kind and giving. It's completely unbridled at that point. Out of control goodness. Out of control goodness. What a world that will be. What a world that would be. Then another thing to be freed from is the law. Now, Christ redeemed, Galatians 3:13, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law. And Galatians 4:5, in order that he might redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. Now, it's not the law itself that we are, quote-unquote, redeemed from. In this case, it's the consequences of the law. the law is perfect and good. The problem is that when you plug me into the law, right, I end up being on the wrong side of the law. So you got the blessings for obedience and the cursings for disobedience. I always end up on this side, okay? And that's the kind of, I'd like to be free to be over on this side, but this side is where I end up. As soon as it tells me something that's good to do, point number one tries to figure a way to do something different. So as soon as Paul says, that, you know, it didn't matter. Thou shalt not covet. You plug something in there, and it looks like a law. Something in me is going to try to find a way to do exactly that. If it's don't touch the third cookie from the left, you know we ain't going to go for any other cookie but that. It doesn't matter. Just it's going to be that thing. It's the old thing. Whatever you do, don't think of elephants. Whatever you do, you know, you can't win that. You can't win that. And once you plug into the law that is righteous and good, and the consequences, the curse of the law, that's where I got to get freed from. It's not that I don't deserve the consequences of the law. See, the problem is that I do. The problem is that I do. But I'd love another chance. I'd love another chance. I'd love continual refreshment and forgiveness as I go to the Lord about this. And so one of the things that was done at the cross was to free us from those inexorable consequences of the curse of the law. Boom, it's going to roll down. And in one of the things that I wrote on the tank, I was talking about that there's this stream of consequences for our actions. That, like in time, there's a model that there's a stream of consequences for our actions that come toward us. And they are either blessings or less than blessings or contrary but cursings. They are discipline, punishment, decay, things of this type, this stream of consequences. And what has happened on the cross is that somebody pushed us out of that stream and stood there and hit the fire hose and took that stream forth. That's the way the cross worked. This is how little Glenn's escape, quote-unquote, the just moral outrage of God at the things that little Glenn does. That's the only way it works. It ain't that I sit there and fight the water back. It's that somebody bigger than me stood in the gap, stood in the breach and said, I'll take his punishment. That's what the cross was about, right? And that's how I get all free. Not by being good, not by doing all these other things, right? But it's by somebody else being good and doing all those other things. So one of the masters is to be free from the consequences of the law in history and beyond. And then death, the law of downhill destructive consequences. So death is a master that is promised to... this is the shroud that covers all nations, he calls it in the Old Testament. He says that the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. And I will swallow it up, he said. And there was, at the memorial service for my daughter, I made the comment about, we've shared our reminiscences of, you know, shared the way we saw this as a family. And then we also had the friends write, we had a little page and we had them send things in. And my remarks, one of the things that I had to do, you know, with my historical bent, was to comment about ancient religions, that the ancient religions in the Old Testament and the ancient Near East, they never offered the hope of ever hugging people again. You know, they would go to a place underground and where you could feed them. You know, or they would get absorbed into a nothingness or something of this type. But you would never get your kid or your loved one to hug again in the body. So you just, nobody would dare to make that kind of promise. So all the gods of the other religions, quote unquote, in the ancient Near East, they would promise these compromises with death. These compromises. We just settle for less. It's the best we can hope for. But there was one God that said, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm sorry. Do not compromise. I'm not going to compromise with it. I will do whatever it takes to make sure you get that shot again. You get that shot again. And so it is that hope, this is my axe to grind this morning about death, is that it just doesn't win. It can hurt, but I even get paid back for the hurt. I get paid back for the hurt because if I were poor, I'd get the land I was supposed to get according to Jesus. I get it back. I get it back plus the penalty payment over on death. I get they had extra sheep, you know, when they stole my sheep, you had to reimburse. We covered this, right? And in the ancient world, part of the shock value of this was in the Greco-Roman culture, the shock value of resurrection from the dead was unbelievable. Because in the tombstones that they would have, Paul says in Thessalonians, he says, we grieve, but not as other people grieve, those that have no hope. And that was Elpida, the word for hope. And they would put that on the tombstones. Those showed up on gravestones in Roman catacombs of just the Romans, pagans. They would have a loved one, and on this thing would say, no hope. No hope. And they had whole schools of philosophy that tried to get people to accept that. Stoically was the phrase. They sit there and say that and view that with nobility instead of getting outraged at that as an atrocity and calling upon God. Says, no, do something. Do something. The outrage element was in there. And I have a book that I read and reread again last week called Life in the Face of Death, the Resurrection Message in the New Testament. It's a scholarly work, so it's got all kind of weirdness in it, and footnotes, and obscure language references, and stuff like that. But in the summary on one of the chapters was particularly good. I wanted to read it this morning. It was on the Christian gospel of resurrection in that context. In the first century A.D., Greco-Roman world, languishing as it was under the shadow of death. In other words, death touched everything. I mean, literally everything was on the shadow of death. You would hire. It was illegal to practice magic in the Roman Empire. You could be punished by death. But people at night would go hire magicians to cast spells to protect their family from death, illness, and from evil spells from other people with political intrigue. In other words, you lived constantly, as Hebrews said, in the fear of death. You constantly were slaves because you were afraid of death. Not for yours, for those that were closest to you. The world lay under the shadow of death came a new message of resurrection that would eventually take the Roman Empire by storm. The gospel of Jesus Christ proclaimed him as an alternative to the emperor, the Son of God, who promised life to the world rather than the bloodshed of Rome. Some of you remember when we were talking about the birth of Jesus that the terms that were used for him, Son of God, had also been used at the same time, been applied to Augustus, Caesar Augustus. He called himself the Son of God. He also called himself the Prince of Peace. They have that thing called the Pax Romana, which was alluded to others called the bloodshed of Rome. This was the peace must be enforced kind of model. And there was a deliberate dig over at the Caesars in the Luke's stories of the Nativity, the announcements there. Promised life to the world rather than the bloodshed of Rome. Likewise, by dealing with the demonic or ghostly forces that had been previously manipulated for nefarious ends by the practitioners of magic, he promised to break the power of the dead over the living. So remember, you could invoke spirits of the dead in the magic Roman world to hassle your enemies and to bother them and things of this type. And so you had this world that was not only did you have to deal with the normal medical issues, death, famine, things of this type, you also had this demonic, otherworldly spirits that could always attack you and just, boom, in the blink of an eye, they were gone. Furthermore, and most important, as the one who had personally dealt with illness and death, he cast back the shadow of death from the world. For it was exactly the boundary between life and death and the barrier between the human and the divine that Jesus Christ crossed, both on his own behalf and on behalf of his followers. Although he himself died, the movement he left in his wake proclaimed that he had escaped from death. This was no avoidance of death, straight in there. Rather, it was an escape from the bowels of the earth of death after having died and been buried. Remember when we studied crucifixion, we pointed out that every other hero in all of the ancient world, about a fourth of them end up being crucified But they were never allowed to die on the cross because it was such an instrument of shame. No hero in Greco-Roman literature could actually finish being crucified because it was such a shameful instrument. So they would get right there and tease you with this and then pull back but not die. But there was one who did all the way. He died and was buried. Neither was this a temporary release from the underworld like some of the heroes had. You'd have a Greek or a Roman figure that would die and go to Hades, and then he would break, you know, cross the river Styx and reappear for, you know, X number of years or whatever to finish some task or something like this. Rather, it became his permanent state of affairs when he had been exalted to heaven. Nor was this simply a reward for his own virtue, since his death was a ransom for many. His victory over death held the promise that he had defeated death on behalf of those who turned to him as well. Christ's resurrection was no mere apotheosis of the soul, which was just a transformation of the soul or exaltation of the soul, for it also involved his body. Apotheosis of the soul held promise only for the elite. In other words, the only people that were candidates for even partial heaven were the elite, the nobles that had enough Roman virtue in them to qualify for promotion after death. And that was still only the soul. You didn't get a body in this deal at all. You were just your soul went up there. If you were really good, those who were not among the great ones, in terms of their achievements or their morality, had little hope. And if they had some bodily disability, their chances were even more remote. As when the gods, during their mockery of the apotheosis of Claudius, who was lame in his right foot, declared, "Look at his body, born under the wrath of heaven." In other words, if you weren't perfect, you weren't going to make it. Now, that's sort of true, if you know your theology right? But we go on the basis of somebody else's perfection. So those of us that are lame of heart or lame of foot get to make it, because there was somebody that wasn't. See, that we get a shared, that's trading places thing, you know. On the other hand, the Christian proclamation of resurrection was filled with promise to all those in a broken world who could not raise themselves from the dust and whose virtue could not save them. They had a champion in Jesus Christ who had gone on ahead of them, and in going ahead of them had provided a ransom that guaranteed their future. For many potential hearers of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the ability of human power, such as armies and stuff like that, to wreak havoc and to kill was a painful fact of their experience. In other words, they knew this. They also knew that it was what it was like for unseen forces to cause intense pain and suffering, and then suddenly to take life away. Human mortality was indeed a grim reality, and the shadow of death hung heavily across the nations. The Christian gospel of resurrection, however, held out a strong and living hope to a dying world. It spoke of a coming kingdom, which was life and not death, of salvation, not corruption. And for those who continued to live under the shadow of death, it presented the assurance that something had been done about human mortality. That a crucified man had defeated death, and that he had done so through resurrection. Something would have been done. So my comment on that was that, as the skeptic that I am, there's only one group of religions, quote unquote, that promise resurrection, bodily resurrection, and only one of them has demonstrated it on a voluntary basis. Only one religious figure has ever said, "I will raise myself from the dead. I lay it down, I have the power to take it back up." And if you're going to bet your hopes and dreams and the way you deal with despair on something, you want to do it on something very, very firm. And that's that empty tomb. It's that empty tomb. And I've been studying that from a, you know, historical, apologetic standpoint for a couple hundred years, it seems like. And it ain't going to slow down, apparently. I told somebody on an email that, you know, over the years, you know, the more you walk with God, what becomes so clear is that He is so much more real than we are.
You know, we're a low resolution version somehow of reality. His brilliance, his incandescence, there's just his promises, his character, his heart is so much more real, vivid life than our most amazing expectations. And this is the hope that, like I say, that the last enemy to be destroyed is death. And as I reflect on that, I think, well, why is that last? Which enemy has to be conquered first? It's our hearts. The hearts have got to be conquered first. See? We have to... when I pray for people to come to know the Lord, I pray that they would give up and see the love, that they would stop fighting the love of Jesus Christ. That's where you... Because that's what ultimately wins the deal, is that when you finally run out of arrogance and steam and pride and shaking your fist at somebody that's sitting there wanting to help you without holding that over against you, once, you know, because we do, we fear treachery, we fear this. You know, there's a lot of us that resist help for that reason, because we know that it's going to come back as an IOU or an invoice somewhere. And those of us that have learned that and been traditioned, you know, we picked that bad habit up of looking through things that way. It's hard sometimes to look at those nail-printed hands and say, that's an illusion. Surely that's another element of trickery. Okay. And it is that heart that went after this. And death is one of these that he's going to take down with an air of finality. And death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire, I think his phrase, Revelation. And then there's false gods. And false gods, in our context, would be false, misleading, and consumptive religious practices. And because we know false gods, they aren't really false gods. You know, these happen, they're either malignant intelligences that are demonic at some kind of character, or generally most of the ones in the Old Testament, in the Bible, are constructs that we make. We create, we take some wood and, we make our own little deity and we sit it up there and we invest stock in it and, you know, stuff that we do, right? And so false gods in most cases, at least in Galatians 4, is that these are false, misleading, and consumptive religious practices. So Galatians 4:8, formerly, Paul says, formerly when you did not know God, you were slaves to those who by nature are not gods. But now that you know God, or rather are known by God, how is it that you are turning back to those weak and miserable principles? Do you wish to be enslaved by them all over again? In other words, in the argument in Galatians and a couple other places, he points out, in Colossians especially too, he points out that religion is just worthless. And it's at some level. I mean, if you understand what I mean by religious practices, and Hebrews talks about the feudal way of life passed on by our forefathers, you know, just working your way, rolling the rock up the hill to try to get to heaven kind of thing, or try to be good enough or something like this. And the practices, the key word there are consumptive. These are religious practices that there are no joy in, where they consume you as opposed to build you up and encourage you and strengthen you. If your devotions, the time that you spend with the Lord, is a chore for more than 4 days running, then you're doing something really wrong. Really wrong. It could be a chore for 2 days running, maybe 3 days running, because sometimes he's going to test you as to why do you do it. Do you do it because you feel good at the end of it? Or do you do it because we're both people and we're meeting here? And I'm worth it and you're worth it. You know. So there are times that he'll, withhold the blessing, just to see if you do. He tested Hezekiah. He left Hezekiah to see what was in his heart, is what it says. So there are times where it just all dries up. And not when you just have a chest cold, but when it just dries up, apart from any other thing, and heaven's made out of brass, and you've gone through the agonizing, bottomless introspection of your life, trying to find every little minute, petty little thing that you could have done to alienate God. Yeah, right. And you are down at the level of pettiness now that was offensive and insulting to both of you for you to even think. You know, it's because I didn't smile, because I didn't think of Jesus as soon as I woke up. God's cut himself. See, at some level, you get into religion. You're back to religious practices as opposed to an interactive relationship that says, hey, if I'm doing something, you need to let me know. I'm thick of, mud balls with hair and teeth. Remember, that's what we are. Mud balls with air and tea floating around the universe here. You know, 80% water, you know, and it's sort of thin mud at that, you know, but not a lot of substance. And so in this case, we tend to fall back into ritual and things of this type. Ritual has its advantages. There are places where God wants us to do patterns and routines, because he can use that to call us back at times when we get cold-hearted sometimes. But one of the things to be freed from is legalism, this legal religiosity that's cold and dead. There was a phrase that somebody used one time about theology as clear as ice and twice as cold. You can definitely have that. You can definitely have that. And that's religious kinds of things, in a bad sense of religion, in a bad sense of legalism and ritualism that doesn't have a passion for God's heart. Then another master, Satan's kingdom. And Satan's kingdom, in our context of these verses, would be macro-cultural forces that restrict our freedom, our creativity, and our transformation. I'll explain that in a minute. For he has rescued us, Colossians, from the dominion of darkness, so that by his death, Hebrews 2, so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Now, we don't have the years that it takes to go through what Satan's kingdom is. But in this particular passage, there's only one or two aspects of it that are drawn out, and that has to do with cultural high-level forces that somehow fight against us being authentic. And if you think about fear of death, for example, as being that second passage, you know, what kind of forces in our culture teach us to act as if we're afraid of death? See? Well, there's tons of this. I mean, there's tons of stuff that says you have to live for the moment, grab for the gusto, do all these things to look younger, act different. You know, there's tons of this stuff that appeals to us that says this is to be completely avoided. Okay? And denied. Living in the denial of this reality. And here, consume your resources doing this. There are forces like that that are work. There are forces that tell us that to work only on the basis of selfishness, that I'm the only one that counts, not just me, but individually. Okay, that'd be a different message if I tried to convince you of that. Right. And there are people that do that. That's clear. That's clear. We've got those too. And what you've got there is somehow, and we don't know how this works. I mentioned this the last time we were together, that we don't sort of how this works psychologically, but it has to do with a vagueness. C.S. Lewis, in his books, would talk about, in his space trilogy, he talked about how in the Screwtape Letters, talk about how the tempter would always have to keep it vague. That somehow vagueness is an enemy of truth. It's not that falsity is its own enemy against truth, but vagueness is also an enemy of truth because it's an enemy against understanding. Because I can sit up there and I can give a speech and not have a clue what I'm talking about, but use all the appropriate buzzwords, you know, and because the audience wouldn't know any better either, I could end up looking really good, right? Because you use all the little words, right? But there's no understanding there, and that's that vagueness. And so there's the forces that go to do with vagueness and image that we don't know a lot about. And they play just as easily back in the Roman world as they do in our civilization, even more so in our civilization because the means of communication is so fast, rapid, and wide bandwidth. Let's put it that way. Okay? So, one of the things that's occurred here is that God's freedom desire for us is to be freed from the impact of those forces on us. So that when I get put into I see an ad in the back of a magazine, or I see a billboard, or I see an advert on television or something, that there's something in me that clicks and says, yeah, right. Something says, look at this. How silly this is. Look what this is selling. Really. Look what this is appealing to. Look at the message. In other words, it's the ability to think critically and to be freed from just swallowing everything that gets pitched at you. And that's a huge problem for us. A huge problem. You got to have that same little inner sense that God grows in our heart to see things that perspective. Just like the old, well, maybe they're not a jerk for cutting me off. Maybe they really have an urgency situation. That's why they're driving so fast. You know. And the same knee-jerk response that looks at an ad says what's good about it and what's bad about it. One of the things I did with my kids when I was over-engineering them at first is that in my oldest, who's now 24 in Philadelphia, when she was 3 and 4, I'm almost ashamed to admit this, after Sesame Street sessions, we would say what was good and what was bad about Ernie and Bert. And so, because I didn't like the way the tall one treated the short one, because it was always so brusque, you know, and I felt that, you know, I want him to at least see that at least he's efficient, but that his interpersonal skills were somewhat lacking. Right? And so we laugh about that now as literally some serious over-engineering, you know. But the point was is that it developed critical thinking to where you both went after the good, not just the critical. See, because there are two sets of errors you can have there. And we're trying to do that. And so what this has to do is developing that same level of understanding and response to the forces that are around us. And then the next one, another one that's called a master, is appetites. Impulsiveness, lack of self-control, losing it in the presence of circus peanuts, those kinds of things. Romans 16:18, for such people are not serving our Lord Christ, but their own appetites. Now, we don't need much elaboration probably on what this entails. Most of us have a spectrum of addictions in our life, and they're everything from things that people have support groups about, and then there are things that people brag about having. So I don't need to go there. It'll be way too convicting for all of us. But suffice it to say, we know that appetites have an ability to dominate our lives and control us in times that it's inappropriate. There are times that we need to do it and give thanks to God. Nothing is to be refused if it is to be thankful God. But, as Paul said, all things are lawful to me, but I will not be captured and mastered by anything. He said, I am too oppositional of a thinker. I refuse to be dominated by something that's even good. And so appetites are another one of the masters that we at least have to develop the freedom to say no to. It may be a good... We don't have to swing completely the opposite way to be a complete aesthetic. You know, wear the hair shirt, starve yourself to death, because that's just as big an addiction can be as anything else. See? I mean, we can take anything good and turn it into something bad with enough practice. Or if you just let go of the wheel in some cases, you'll end up over there. See? So appetites are definitely a master. And then closely related to this are addictions, desires and pleasures. At one time, we too were foolish, disobedient, deceived, and enslaved by all kinds of passions and pleasures. And that's just another... Appetites are not quite as addictive as an addiction builds this a compulsive character about it, whereas the appetites are just a little bit milder and wider in the context here. Now, serving their own appetites means that you plan how you're going to take care of that. Romans says, give no thought to the lust of the flesh as to how to fulfill them, how to plan to satisfy them. This, by the way, was the verse that Augustine read that confronted him with the gospel, and that's how he got saved, literally. He ended up trusting Christ because he realized that this was what his life was about, that he spent all of his life trying to engineer himself into questionable situations. And he did this, and he realized that there was a slavery associated with that. That did not give. He was a slave to this. And the philosophers, and he was a Neoplatonist, they had the same thing, that you have to be careful. You have to distance. You have to transcend a little bit so that when something as good is up, you can say no or yes. Paul said, I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. Right? Whether I'm hungry or full. See? Because there are challenges associated with being full. Huge challenges. What happens to Israel when they got in the land, they got full? What did God tell them was going to happen? They were going to take a nap, a moral nap. Right? They were going to sit back and forget God. And so you can do that way, or you can, when you're hungry, you can curse God. So that, you know, we're gifted at this, at doing something of this type. Now, these masters, what we're studying, see, in this course is what happened actually on that Friday, on the cross. Now, there are a number of these masters are not going to be solved or overcome by what was done, quote unquote, at the cross. It wasn't done then. Okay? Death will be destroyed at the second coming. See? So the price has been paid, the groundwork is done, and we're seeing victory over death right now in our lives, in our consciences, in our hearts, and our various and sundry things. But there's still work to be done on a couple of these masters at the other end of history when we get into God's future. So when we come back now, next week we'll get back into the rest of the syllabus about the kinds of problems that we face today, because most of us are aware that most of us, you know, put our confidence in the Lord. We came face our heart to heart with God back somewhere in our history, and everything was completely cleared up right there about our future with Him, and we were surprised that He didn't take us to heaven right then, and that we've been still down here floundering around for a couple of decades, still learning, still growing. Of course, our appreciation for that event has changed dramatically, too. So the more times I have to come with blood on my hands and say, I need a little cleaning here again. I said this, I didn't say this, I thought this, I didn't think this, I didn't do this. You still got some water, still got some cleansing. Well, every time I go through that process, guess how much bigger God gets? His heart gets bigger and bigger. And every time I look in his book, and I sit there and I say, you know, in the mornings I say, show me your heart. I want to see the real heart, because it's in there. And he'll peel it back. He entrusts himself to the righteous. And there's one passage I want to close with today, and we'll get back into the how we get free next time, with something I ran across in my devotions today. And I'm not going to tell you the passage because I don't want you to read it, because this is a test. This is a test. I'm going to read it and have a fill in the blank, and you tell me what goes in the blank. Okay? And if I told you, well, maybe I could give you the wrong passage and I could see who's cheating. I will give you a hint from the Old Testament. Okay. Nevertheless, this is about after the exile of Israel. Nevertheless, I will bring health and healing to it. I will heal my people and will let them enjoy abundant peace and security. I will bring Judah and Israel back from captivity and rebuild them as they were before. I will cleanse them from all the sin they have committed against me and will forgive all their sins of rebellion against me. Then this city will bring me renown, joy, praise, and honor before all nations on earth that hear of all the good things I do for it. And all nations of the earth will be in awe and will tremble at, that's the blank. What are they going to be in awe and tremble at? Does anybody know? All right, let me finish it. They will be in awe and will tremble at the abundant prosperity and peace I provide for you. Not tremble in awe at His power or His magnificence, but how good-hearted He is. Prosperity and the abundance to His people. See, this is the God that did the cross thing for us, did the resurrection thing for us. And it's, He says, if you seek me with all your heart, I got a heart to show you who I am and what I am in your life. And I will be with you in the dark times and the bright times and the red times and the green times and every time. And so this is the one that's why I use the phrase at the beginning, anxious for our freedom. Anxious for us to experience this freedom from the things in our lives that hold us back, these appetites, addictions, lack of understanding, just bumbling around, the things that hold us back, because He's interested in abundance and prosperity. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we are amazed at Your heart, Your goodness, Your care, Your tenderness, Your desire to be a part of our lives, to be in there with us, to cuddle us, to comfort us, to love us, to heal our wounds, to comfort us in times of depth and sorrow, to bring smiles to our heart, to help us love one another, comfort one another, to encourage one another, that You are in the midst of real life, that You are the real thing in life. I pray, Father, that this week as we run across these masters in our lives and we give us insight, help us recognize them, help us to see those and say, oh, that's what we're talking about. That's what You want me to be free from. This brokenness that I've got in this thing, or this calloused heart that I've got here, or this way I'm compromising here, or relationships that need repair here. So open our heart and help us have the confidence in what you have done on the cross through your Son in a death, burial, and resurrection in our place, that we can have confidence that the life that comes from you can flow in our relationship and through our interaction with you into the nasty here and now of life, that your beauty, your transformation, and the stuff that grows roses could express itself in our life and our relationships and the way we deal with people. We want to be more like your Son in his gentleness, his meekness, his moral outrage at treachery, and his kindness, and overall his forgiveness and acceptance of others. So do that for us. We really want to be better like that this week. And teach us and open our hearts and open our eyes as we go forward. For your Son's sake, amen.